You're listening to WBAI 99.5 FM Pacifica Radio. And online at WBAI.org.
The role of media in a democratic society should be to empower people to make decisions.
WBAI, speaking truth to power for over 50 years.
You have very few powerful media outlets that are actually doing the two things that I think are the most central aims of good journalism, which is to give voice to the voiceless and hold those in power accountable.
WBAI, your community alternative.
And you're tuned to Listener Sponsored Radio, WBAI 99.5 FM in New York. Tonight, I have a very special episode of Night Shift. I have several interviews for some movies, for some books, for some productions, things that are going on in the arts and culture. Also have some best of Night Shift that I'll be playing for you, and of course, some DGM. So stay tuned. We have an interview with Paul Brennan, producer and co-president of Burn Later Productions. We have an interview with John Goodwin, president of Galaxy Press, who is the person that oversees the Writers of the Future Awards that happen every year. It's in their 31st year now. Also, going to have an interview with author and screenwriter Jesse Andrews, who is the writer of the new film Me and Earl and the Dying Girl, which I can't say enough good things about, and an interview with Shira Pippen, who is an actress and director of a film called Welcome to Me, starring Kristen Wiig, that comes out on DVD next week. So stay tuned to Night Shift, 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 Night Shift.
I have no idea why I'm here. I don't know what I'm doing. idea how to tell this story. I don't even know how to start it. This is the story of my senior year of high school and how it destroyed my life.
Your father and I want to talk to you about something sad. Rachel Kushner has been diagnosed with leukemia.
That sucks.
It sucks.
It sucks quite a bit.
You might be someone who could make Rachel feel better.
I don't need your stupid pity.
I'm not here because I pity you. I'm actually here because my mom is making me.
It's actually worse. Everyone was going to find out sooner or later.
One thing you can do if you don't want to talk to anyone is just enter a subhuman state. Pretend you're someone annoying.
Hi, Rachel. I'm really sorry you have cancer.
That's exactly what I'm talking about.
So if this was a touching romantic story, our eyes would meet and suddenly we would be furiously making out with the fire of a thousand suns. But this isn't a touching romantic story.
Anyway.
Yep. This little friend.
Earl's just my coworker.
I've known him since kindergarten.
What you got, cat? Wanna fight? Didn't think so, punk-ass cat.
So you and Greg are coworkers?
Nah, we friends. Dude's terrified of calling somebody his friend. Lou's got issues.
But how are you coworkers?
We make films.
Movies?
They're terrible.
Greg, you never told me.
The idea behind each one was, we took a film that we liked, and we made the title stupider, and then made a new film to reflect the new title. It's a formula that only produces horrible films, but for some reason we keep using it.
You need to make a film for Rachel.
Hi, Rachel. I don't really know you, but I believe in you.
I know you're Jewish, but God has a plan for you.
Out of all the people in the school, I don't hate you.
Damn.
You guys were making a movie for me.
We tried a bunch of stuff and it's not that good.
Now is not the time for your, I'm Greg, I suck, nothing I do is any good thing.
We agreed to do a film that we have no idea what it should look like or even be. What was I thinking?
I'm so tired of you treating this girl like she a burden. Because somebody actually cares about you, her life is over after this.
Life can keep unfolding itself to you just as long as you pay attention to it.
It was the best of times. Worst of times.
It's so much harder than I thought it would.
It was life.
Me, Earl, and the Dying Girl is a film that comes out this Friday. As a film critic, and some of you who know and have listened to me a long time know I'm also a filmmaker. And every now and then, with the multitude of films that I watch, I get to see a film that actually inspires me, makes me want to go back to filmmaking, or further the efforts I'm already putting towards. Me and Earl and the Dying Girl is such a film. It's directed by Alfonso Gomez Rejon, and it's based on the novel and with a screenplay by Jesse Andrews. And he's a first-time writer, and this is his first screenplay. It's a really terrific film. It won the Audience Award and the Drama Award at the Sundance Film Festival this past year. And I have to say, it's very deserving. What you'll enjoy about it, like I did, I believe, is how the story is told. It's funny. It's about something serious, but it's funny. It's irreverent. It's original. It plays with time. It does all kinds of things that just really make you sort of excited, for me anyway, excited about film and what you can do with film and the kind of stories you can tell. I got a chance to talk with Jesse Andrews about storytelling, of course, making this film, his process, and what the journey was like for him. You, of course, know my first question was to ask him, when did he first know he wanted to be a storyteller?
You know, that starts early, and you find yourself doing it, I think, if that's what's in you. Honestly, I was doing it, my little sister is about 6.5 years younger than me, and I taught her how to read, you know, we're just sitting around the house. We had, like, alphabet magnets on the fridge, and I did it, I'm realizing now, because it meant that I could make some books for her to read, and then I would have a readership, and that's what I want. So, you know, it's a totally self-serving thing to do. And I made these, I stapled together little loose-leaf books with pictures of woodland animals and their adventures, you know, foxes and were the two types of animal that I liked the most. I don't know why. Raccoons eat garbage, so that's disgusting, but for whatever reason, I didn't care about that. From that point on, but then, you know, in college, high school and college, I wasn't really doing it. I studied math for a while and then art history. I didn't do any creative writing courses or get an MFA or anything like that. It's just, once I graduated, I found myself wanting to go back to it. I couldn't see any career for myself that would consume me in the same way. Same way, so.
Now, and just the two more contextual questions like that. In your estimation, what makes a good story and a story worth telling?
Oh, man. Wow. It's a very... See, that's why you should do an MFA, because then you're equipped to answer. But, you know, a good story is... I don't know if you know what a good story is until you start telling it and see what happens when people start listening. You know, the process for me of writing and storytelling is very much about you start doing it, and whatever plans you have, whatever outline and blueprint you've created, those are really important, but those are also going to change completely because you learn by doing, or at least I do. So a good story is just one that people will listen to, you know, and I don't know, you see it in their eyes, you know, when it's clicking, when it's carrying them along with its own momentum, you know, and when it means something, when it leaves them feeling energized and not enervated, you know.
Okay. Well, tell me now, what inspired you to want to write this story, and how personal was this for you?
It's certainly not, you know, autobiographical. It's not a story that happened to me. I wanted to write something funny, something for teens, and something that was about something, you know, about something kind of hard to look in the eye. And then maybe comedy, maybe laughter makes that a little easier. Although I didn't expect it to get, like, you know, wrapped up with a bow.
Right.
So as I was setting out to write a book like that, you know, in my family, my grandfather was terminally ill, and I was thinking a lot about dying, you know, about death, about the exchanges too that I was having with him, you know, especially my mother was having with him, that always felt incomplete and always felt like you could say, you should have said something different. You should have known what that thing was. You should have done different. You want those exchanges to somehow contain your entire relationship with the person that's close to you that might not be here that much longer, and they never can. You know, that's what you want is closure, and you're not going to get it. And that's a measure of how big and complex and rich that relationship is, you know, but it hurts, and it's okay for it to hurt, you know? That's what that process is. The hurt means that it meant something and will always mean something. So I wanted to write something funny about that, which is kind of either a good idea or the idea of a monster.
Right.
But it just seemed worth doing.
Well, you know, it's interesting. One of the things I really enjoyed about the film, as you mentioned, is the humor. Literally laugh-out-loud humor and sort of a dry sense of humor. And I feel like, you know, it's like you know them a little bit if you get into their world, their music, their dance, their film, their story, whatever. How much of what you were trying to do and what you're trying to say did you feel you needed to be able to say with humor that you might not be able to? And I say this just to give you the context that I feel comedy and science fiction are related in that you can talk about issues that would be heavy-handed to talk about anywhere else if it weren't wrapped in that genre.
Yeah. Heavy-handed and even kind of unbearable.
Right.
You know, I mean, unless you're in the mood for it or the moment in your life when you're going to be thinking about that no matter what, it's going to speak to you. But, I mean, it's also, you know, I just have the worldview of nothing is ever only sad and nothing is ever only funny.
Right.
You know, the two are always mixed up in each other. And, you know, more than that, too. Beautiful and ugly, and, you know, loud and quiet. That's anything that I want to make is hopefully going to be suspended between these different feelings. It's just that feels right, that feels real to me. Certainly the comedy that I like the most usually is grounded in something kind of tough, you know, like
right.
comedy like Louis C.K., you know, he's usually, when he gets the laughs, there's some undercurrent of sadness or darkness there that is the engine of that comedy. And in turn, that comedy allows you to look at that dark or sad or difficult thing.
Well, I like that phrase, dark engine comedy. Now, let me ask you this. Now, did you always envision it as a film? I mean, because, you know, what the main character, Greg and Earl do is make these again, a great subplot, these films, these remakes. Did you always envision it one day being a film, or was that just like a fantasy?
No, yeah, I really didn't. you know, it was almost, I almost didn't let myself think of it as being a publishable book. Writing the book, I had already tried to write two other books, you know, and written a bunch of drafts of each and failed to get them published, and, you know, and rightfully so, because they weren't really publishable, because they weren't very good, but, you know, so this one, the prize was just to get it on a bookshelf somewhere, somehow, and there was no, I didn't let myself hope that it would interest someone as an adaptation.
Hmm. And so tell me a little bit about your journey turning the book into a screenplay, because the screenplay is a very, very different screen. You know, film is a very different medium. And of course, you always have to lose a lot. What was that journey like then, going back, having had the success, and now you're going to this other level?
Yeah, it's super different. I mean, I had a lot of help, and, you know, the more help, more than anyone, I had it from Dan Fogelman, who's a producer on the film, and whose idea it was for me to adapt my own book. And also, I had an agent named Anna DeRoy, who oversaw the book-to-film process, you know, the selling of the film rights. But Dan, you know, he shepherded me through that process with just a surreal amount of generosity and patience. And so it made it a lot easier than it would have been, you know. I think the one thing, too, when you write your first screenplay, it is a lot easier if you've already written it as a 300-page novel.
Definitely.
So, you know, so
definitely.
You know who these characters are. You know how they talk. You know what the thematic bones of the story are. Although those change, too. You know, in a movie, you can't be quite as oblique or elliptical as when you're writing a book. The things that are learned have to be a little bit more on the surface. And you don't want to be heavy-handed with them, but if they're totally subterranean, totally buried, it's not going to be satisfying. It's probably not going to land in the same way as it might with a book.
Mm.
Or maybe you can just get away with it more in a book, and people don't really...
they don't realize you've done it.
Anyway, which I think is the case with this book, is that, you know, some people are very satisfied by it, and some people read it and are left wondering what did I just read? Why did I read that? Which is fine, you know. So yeah, that's the whole thing. You put it out in the world, get some people don't. You know, it's just Dan. He let me make mistakes. He told me that, you know, every good script has mistakes in it, and they're not really mistakes. They're just, you know, according to the conventions, they're mistakes, but in practice, they're the reasons why a movie is interesting.
Well, you know, it's interesting you say that, because, like I said, you know, I go to every film as both a film goer, as a film critic, and a filmmaker, and what I enjoyed about your film was just that you broke some rules. You know, you do things they always tell you don't do. Oh, don't have a narrator. Oh, don't do flashbacks. Oh, don't play with time. You did all those things, and you did it so, it was so refreshing to see. Tell me a little bit about that, just playing with, you know, a fractured narrative and things like that. Were those what you initially had in mind, or did that come with various drafts?
Well, that, yeah, from the very beginning, that was a big part of it. And, you know, because it's adapted from a book that's told in the first person, and because the voice of the narrator is such a strong part of the book, you know, the way he talks and the way he sees the world, it just seemed impossible to me to convey, to get to that same place and convey that tone without voiceover, without a narrator. And honestly, like, yeah, I've just never had a problem with voiceover and narrator. Like, I love that stuff. And maybe sometimes it's hokey, sometimes it doesn't work. But when it works, it's just so good. It just guides in this wonderful way. And it's, oh, man, yeah, it's, I hate to think if, like, I had had some kind of anti-voiceover dogma drummed into me before I started writing this, because I wouldn't have known how to go about it.
Right.
And I don't think the result would have been as good.
Well, definitely not. And again, it must be somewhat surreal to, you know, win the audience award and win the grand jury prize, at, you know, with your first film, your first screenplay. That's got to be, you know, sort of, you know, gratifying. So my question to you is, because I tend to believe that as you define your art defines you. What do you learn about yourself in this whole process, writing the book, making the film, and all of that, coming to where you are now?
Oh, man. All right, that's a big question, you know.
Okay.
I learned, I guess, I got to put my worldview a little bit into somewhat more concrete of a form, and I found that it was more hopeful than I think of myself. I think of myself as kind of a pessimistic person, you know, tries to have really low expectations and, and stuff's often not going to work out, and there's a lot of, like, pain and darkness in the world. And yet, the worldview that I came to through writing this and through adapting it and watching Alfonso and actors and everyone, the department had to realize it, was that, you know, I guess I do have some faith that in the interestingness of people, you know, that no matter what you expect of someone, you know, no matter what picture you have of them in your head, the truth is always much more complex and beautiful and infinite than you thought. People can always surprise you, no matter what you think of them. Even if you think of them as surprising, they'll surprise you. And, you know, and so there's an infinity there that is something that you can have faith in, you know, and take some encouragement and strength from. That just people are pretty cool. I don't know. I guess that's it. I like people. They're
okay.
Good.
Okay. Well, I know they're going to cut us off. My last question is, how surreal was it for you to have had these characters in your head talking to you and then meet actors who could embody them and actually be these characters?
Well, you know, these actors end up being so much more
right.
than what's on the page of the script. And that's the really incredible part, is when they start to depart from whatever very limited picture you have of them and watch them bring more to it, you realize that there's all these hidden cadences in the stuff that you've written, you know, in the dialogue that you've written, which already has a cadence, you know, but it can be said completely differently. And that's a really granular example. I mean, like, you know, the way they talk and look and carry themselves, you know, the way they look at things, the way they look at each other, it's just so much more, you know. You realize how much filling in there is to do with the outlines that a script provides, and that, you know, if you've written a good script, it's only good because it's given actors and the director and everyone, you know, material to work with, opportunities to bring their talent, their gift, you know, a stage on which to show what they can do. You know, if you're trying to legislate any of those things from the page, then you're restricting them, and it's not a good thing to be doing. I think it is sometimes tempting to do it as a writer. Say, like, no, the character has to say it exactly this way.
Mm.
And the camera has to go exactly here. And if you free yourself from that and just try to, you know, just convey the tone, the emotional dynamics of the scene, that's the point. And now I'm talking about writing and not the wonderful actors, which you asked me about. I mean, no, they're just, you know, they're so gifted. And they make your characters so much richer than you ever thought they could be.
Well, I really enjoyed your film. I look forward to your next Dark Engine comedy.
Thanks so much.
All right, thanks, man. Me and Earl and the Dying Girl opens up wide this Friday. Another Dark Engine comedy, or what they call a black comedy drama, is a film called Welcome to Me. It stars Kristen Wiig, James Marsden, Linda Cardellini, and Wes Bentley, and it's written by Elliot Lawrence. This is a film, it's about a single woman who ends up winning $86 million and then decides to go off meds and finance a TV show where she literally airs her dirty laundry and does all kinds of things. But it's a meditation on a lot of things, on how we're obsessed with celebrity and being a celebrity, and just all the attraction and cult of fame that we have, and, of course, the addiction we have to TV. So it deals with a lot of things, and it's actually pretty funny. It's a film that if you missed it when it was in the theaters, you should definitely catch on DVD. I got a chance to talk to the director, Shira Piven, who herself is an interesting director. She's also an actress and a producer, and she's married to Adam McKay, who is a very famous producer. But I got a chance to talk to her about, of course, storytelling.
Everybody comes to our beautiful planet Earth to
do something great, something unique, something that only you were born to do.
14, there's 57, 15, and 54, and 39.
Thanks for calling the California Lottery. If you're calling to report a winning, just say, I'm a winner at any time.
I'm a winner at any time.
I was born in the year 1971 in Simi Valley, California.
Now, I'd like to get a volunteer from the audience. What's your name?
My name is Alice Klieg. I won $86 million.
She really won the lottery? Seriously, can someone Google that?
You must be the big winner. Hi, I'm Rich.
Me too. I want a talk show with me as the host.
You want to talk about current events?
No.
What kind of stuff do you want to talk about?
Me. How much will that cost?
$15 million.
Oh, and I want to come in on a swan boat.
You're off your meds, you're living in a reservation casino, and you're hosting your own talk show.
It's a new era. $86 million Alice.
We go live in 5, 4, 3. What is she doing?
No, I think she's a little frozen.
You're on TV now.
Hello, I'm Alice Klieg, and welcome to me.
And so it begins.
Ladies and gentlemen, meatloaf cake.
What's the next piece?
No, we're on this for a while.
Thank you, baby.
No problem, baby.
So good.
We have a few bumps to iron out.
Why doesn't it look like Oprah?
Because you ate a cake made out of hamburger. Someone's been tampering with my makeup bag. Someone's been tampering with my makeup bag!
You are found guilty!
She's a menace, Rich.
Good morning. My name is Alice Klieg, and welcome to me.
Welcome to me.
Welcome to me.
Me.
And welcome to me.
I'm speaking to Shira Piven, who is the director of Welcome to Me, which comes out on DVD June 16th. So, when did you first know you wanted to be a storyteller?
That's a fantastic question. I was writing from a really young age, probably like 11 or 12. I was writing in a journal, but I grew up in an acting environment. My family My parents were actors and teachers, as well as directors, probably actors first and foremost, and as well as teachers. But I would say in high school, I really fell in love with acting first, and I wanted to tell stories through acting, but I also was writing a little bit in high school and directing a little bit. And even when I was acting, it was kind of my passion all through my teens and 20s, but I had a feeling in the back of my head that I would also end up directing, but I didn't know I would grow out of acting. I really don't have the need to do that anymore. I feel sort of like I grew out of it and grew into directing. Probably around age 29, I started directing theater and eventually made my way to film. But I find it very, very similar creative process.
Okay. I just want to ask you a couple contextual questions like that. My second question is, why do you think we as human beings need to tell stories? What do you think the purpose of story is?
I think we tell stories to connect with each other and to understand each other and to understand our world. I think we need to do it like breathing or dreaming. I think it's very inherent in who we are.
Okay, I like that answer. And then my last question like that is, in your estimation, what makes a good story and a story worth telling?
What makes a good story? I guess my first criterion is originality. I feel I'm drawn to stories that have an element that we have not heard before. I think we're always kind of in dialogue with other stories and other, I think it's impossible to be totally original. Not impossible, but difficult. And I think there's always recognizable or familiar elements in stories, and I think that's really good. But I think having an element of originality so that we're surprised and that we're surprised and gain some sort of new insight. Those kinds of stories I want to hear. I really, really don't want to hear the same old thing anymore.
Well, let me just say, as a film critic, I concur. And tell me a little bit about Welcome to Me. How did this project first come to you, and what attracted you to it?
It was written by a good friend of mine who's also a colleague of mine, but I'd never read any of his screenplays. And I fell in love with it. A mutual friend told me about it, and I fell in love with this script in a way I don't ever remember feeling. It's this feeling of this character is already alive for me in my mind, and I want to bring her and her world to life. I love working with Elliot, the writer, and it started out as a pilot, actually, for kind of a... you know, leading him down a bad path or not, but it's possible he could have tried to make it into a series, but I am so happy that he said yes. He was enthusiastic, and we've kind of been good friends and we've always been good friends, but we've collaborated really harmoniously on this.
Okay. Well, I have to say, seeing the film and seeing Kristen Wiig in the role, I really can't picture anybody else playing this now. Was she your first choice? Did she, how did you discover that? Tell me about the casting in general, and specifically casting Kristen Wiig.
It's funny. That is a universal statement about the movie that people can't imagine anyone else but Kristen in the role. I have to say it's pretty great. And when we had a lot, we started out just with a list of actresses, but I really wanted an actress who was inherently a comedian, who also had a sort of a darker tragic or dramatic side and had a vulnerability. And there's only one other actress I can think of really well. There's two other. I think Joan Cusack and Molly Shannon.
Yeah.
They have that too. There's a sadness underneath the funny part of them. And Kristen has that. Kristen was really the right one for this role. And she was our first choice. And we felt that she, you know, we had a feeling if she would just read the script, and it's always hard to get people to read scripts. If she just read the script, then we had a feeling that she would love it. It's such a great role for a woman. And the nice thing was that she did love it, and she had similar feelings that I did about it. So she felt, she didn't right away feel that it was a comedy, and she really felt like Alice was a real person. And we both just instinctively approached it that way.
Well, you know, it's funny. This film struck me on a number of levels and a number of chords. One of them is just, you know, we live in a society today where, you know, with the advent of social media, it's tapped into something about, you know, everybody wants to be essentially the star of their own show. And I think that this movie kind of addresses that in some way. And most people don't think that they have any kind of mental illness. What are your thoughts on that? And was that one of the things that you liked?
Yeah, I feel like that's at the heart of the movie. I feel like one of my favorite lines is the really simple line where Wes Huntley, it's James Marsden's character of Rich. He turns, you know, his lawyer is saying, like, how did you get yourself into this mess with this woman and her TV show? And he just goes, and just says, she wants to be televised.
Huh.
And people, lately, it's this whole reality TV thing. People become famous without having really done anything.
Yes.
And it's a very strange contradiction in terms. So I feel like it's a little bit of a strange world where people do want to have their own, you said it, people want to have their own TV show and they want to be televised. And it's not necessarily healthy for anyone.
Oh, as a matter of fact, it's almost like the inverse of going on your meds. It's like you need to stop watching TV or something to kind of go back to reality where, you know, TV is like a drug.
Yeah, I think it is actually a drug. I really think it is. I don't think there's a lot of difference. But I do think that Alice is a contradiction. I do think that she's a frustrated artist as well. And that's what I love about the movie. So if the things in life are not black or white, that, yeah, it's kind of messed up, this whole idea of wanting to be televised and airing her personal laundry and her, you know, her childhood stories of vindictive feelings towards old friends on the air. It's definitely unhealthy, but there is part of Alice that is artistic and wants to express herself. And I think the guy Rayner, who supposedly studies her, studies her in school, I think he senses that. He senses that there's something about Alice that's both a little screwed up and also kind of a pure creative impulse there.
Most definitely. I agree with that. Most definitely. Well, I'm also curious for you now putting this thing together, because it sounds like it was a bit of a journey. You know, again, you know, collaborating with a friend is always can be a very rewarding experience. What did you learn about yourself in making this film? Because I kind of feel like as you define your art defines you, and this is your second feature.
I learned that I really love making movies.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
That you have to really be passionate about the subject you're working on, which I was about this, because you're devoting a whole chunk of your life to a project, and you have to really love it. And doing this project was really a joy. I also learned that that I definitely gravitate towards material that is a little bit heightened, that has kind of two conflicting or clashing elements. A little, you know, a touch of magic realism, but not not necessarily exactly that.
Right.
Just two elements that come together that kind of make it a little bit more layered and complicated. Those are stories that I'm drawn to. But yeah, I'm sure there are other more personal things that I learned while doing this movie that, that are harder to kind of define, because doing a project like this does change you in some way.
Sure. And what was last question then. What was the most challenging part of making this film, and what's been the most rewarding so far?
Well, the most rewarding has just been getting the opportunity to make the film, because every aspect of it has been pretty wonderful in its own way. And the most challenging, for me, pre-production is kind of the most challenging because it contains the most unknown elements. So I remember just having constant stomach knots during the pre-production process and really not fully believing that this movie was going to get made until we were on set. And then once we were done with the first day of shooting, once we were in the middle of the first day of shooting, I really relaxed. I think I'm always going to find pre-production a big challenge, because there's so many things that you have to set in place before you get to the first day of shooting.
Sure.
That have to be right for the shoot to go well. I'm trying to think what else.
There's so many things that can go wrong.
Yeah. I think I find pre-production really challenging, and also, the process of kind of waiting to hear, with an indie movie, waiting to hear about distribution is also pretty nerve-wracking.
Sure. Well, I could easily talk with you for a while. I thank you, and what's next?
I'm working on two different screenplays that they're both adaptations of short stories, and I'm also helping a writer develop a book into a feature. So there's sort of three projects I have in the air right now that hopefully will come to fruition as films pretty soon.
All right. Well, then I hope I get to talk to you again. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Okay. Thank you.
need to be so excited about Oxford.
We have to work twice as hard as the men. We have to be twice as good.
Oh, here we go. Vera, come back here now!
Wordsworth, Shelley, or Byron. All these romantics aren't good for you, you know.
Do we have a suffragette in our hands?
I will be, given the chance.
Be strong, be brave, be loyal to your homeland.
Now we're a nation at war. All the papers are saying it'll be short and fast.
Well, I can assure you it's never short and it's never fast.
Edward, my little brother, suddenly so grown up.
He's only 18.
There are boys from the town who signed up already. How will it look if I'm not among them?
He was born to make his mark in the world.
Roland, you've signed up.
I have to go. How many generations get the chance to be involved in something like this?
I am coming back.
I can't stay here buried in books, not now. I need to be there.
You're not angels of mercy swooping down to mop the brows of grateful men.
Oh, God.
Especially those who've come down from an ivory tower.
I shall never be afraid to confront the real.
I want to know the truth.
Highest news from the front.
We share a memory that is worth all the rest of the world.
This part of you. Don't destroy it.
It might be gone already.
We send our men to war
because we think it's the right thing, the honorable thing. No more of it.
Next film is a film that opened up this past Friday. It's a film called Testament of Youth, and it stars Alicia Vikander and Kit Harington. Alicia Vikander, you may remember from the great science fiction film that came out earlier this year called Ex Machina. She's also got quite a number of roles coming up. She's really an actress to watch. And Kit Harington, who you may know from Game of Thrones. The director, James Kent, has an interesting background because he started in documentaries and TV and the BBC and whatnot. And this is a period piece. It's about a young woman who's coming of age during World War I. But as is something of the trend today, it's a story about a woman, and this is based on her real memoirs, about a woman who really was kind of a proto-feminist. What she wanted to do and who she became was really kind of outlined or really began in that those 4 to 5 years of World War I. It's a World War I memoir, and the character is Vera Brittain. In America, she's not so well known, but in England, she's known as one of the most vocal and articulate pacifists of the 20th century. I got a chance to talk to the director, James Kent, and of course, talk to him about storytelling, making this film, why he wanted to do it, what he thought he could bring to it, and of course, when did he first know he wanted to be a storyteller?
Oh, I think I remember, like, my mom used to read Lord of the Rings to me. I mean, that's a huge book, and I just thought stories, that you just get lost in them, don't you? We all love stories, and I think, you know, it wasn't long after that age, which must have been about 8 or 9, that I began shooting a few things on my own little cine camera. And then when I went to university, I wrote a lot for the university magazine. I've always wanted to tell stories, as far as I can remember.
Okay. And I guess two more contextual questions like that. In your opinion, what makes a good story and a story worth telling?
You know, I think what makes a good story and a story worth telling is a story that's not obvious. The stories I find I want to switch off on are the ones that I feel I'm being patronized, and I'm being talked down to, and I'm being infantilized. And I think as you get older, so much cinema feels like they're trying to hit all those moments.
Yes.
And they're not allowing me to find them for myself. Does that make sense? And I think, the films that I love, I just love films where I feel I've been treated as an intelligent human being.
I concur. As a film critic, you're preaching to the choir. And then yeah. My last question is, why do you think we as human beings need to tell stories?
Human beings have always needed, you know, it's a cliche, but cavemen did those drawings on the caves of horses and rhinos and God knows what. You know, we need stories to make sense of our lives, and we need stories to give as entertainment, actually, to be like, you know, I think, you know, I look at artists and I think what makes really truly great artists is they never lose touch with their childhood. There's something childlike about their view of the world and their excitement and stimulation by the world. And I think, you know, you only have to look at primary school kids and see their eyes and how they're glazed and just lost in it. What a fabulous state to be in. You know, they didn't even take any drugs. I mean, that is something.
No, I really, again, I concur. Well, now, I'm curious now, looking at this film and looking at your career, you know, you started out, you know, in television and you did documentaries and things like that, and you've definitely done a number of period pieces. What are your thoughts on just the impact and the importance of history and maybe what it tells us about today?
Oh, I'm passionate about history. I majored in history. I'm a huge, and you know, let's be honest, Mike, that's storytelling, isn't it? History
is
a pack of stories that we like to tell about good kings, good queens, bad queens. You know, I think that history is a wonderful way of reminding people that there's a continuum, that we are responsible for this planet, for the lifespan on which we're on it, and we will become our own part of history, and we will be judged. You know, this generation, let's talk about the environment for a minute. This generation will be judged for what they did for the environment in a historical sense. So we think we're so important because we're here now. It's very humbling to know that we will become a chapter in the history of this world. I think that's a really important thing to realize about our lives and about our role on this planet.
I couldn't agree with you more. Now, tell me about how you came across or how this project came to you and what your take was on these memoirs of Eric Brittain.
You know, I guess the producers chose me for this film because I have both the documentary background, therefore this is a real story. I've done some fairly catastrophic events like 9/11 and Auschwitz, big film about the Holocaust. And so I had that kind of gritty capacity to take on disaster and think about how you humanize that. And at the same time, I'd done drama work, which was very much about the story of single women battling their way through life in an historical context.
Yes, you have.
And so those two things sort of combined, I think, probably meant that I defined for them the kind of perfect director that would make a really good job of producing Testament of Youth.
And what was it? Is it those things, those elements that have been in your work that made you want to do this when the project was brought to you?
I'm always looking for something new. It's not like I want to make something that's a sort of synthesis of things I've done. And what felt really new to me about Testament of Youth was that I could do this as a very subjective film. Because it's a memoir from a woman who really wears her heart on her sleeve. I mean, she's a powerhouse, isn't she? That I felt I could turn this into a kind of very private, intimate journey. It's not atonement. It's not, Room with a View. It's a film that's very subjective. It's Vera's film. She owns it. She possesses it. She experiences it. She suffers. She loves. It's her story, and I felt I could turn my filmmaking skills, could in a way refract that and make it incredibly experiential. It's through her eyes, and I think that makes a uniquely powerful story.
Well, you know, there are a number of things you did in the film in terms of how you told the story that I really did find refreshing. For instance, there are a number of sequences where she's having memories of the man she loves. And there's just visuals. There's just visual, like, snapshots in her mind, details that we didn't even notice maybe or weren't even shot in the scene, but they're things she would notice having been in them. How did you come to that?
Well, it was one of the things I felt strongly about. I felt, since the death of my own father, I think of him in these iconic moments, and there's like three or four of those moments that keep coming back to me. I don't have a great range of thoughts. It's these particular moments, and I think when you fall in love, as she is with Roland, it's those moments where he looks and it's just what she now sees he was thinking, he was communicating. He was a very private, rather timid young man. She was his first proper girlfriend. And because of that, looks that she also didn't have any experience of, Of course, when she looks back, she sees that he meant something very different in that moment. And I think it's that reinterpretation of events that we all do that makes those moments live with us for the rest of our lives.
Yeah, I agree. And what I liked about it, it's her looking back and remembering looks he gave her. So you kind of wonder what he was thinking, too. And you knew that there's a connection. Well, another thing that you did in the film that, I enjoyed how you don't really pander to the audience. It's like, I'm telling you something. Hopefully you get it. If you don't get it, just keep going. You know, there's a sequence in the film where we look back at all the places where they've been. You know.
Oh yes.
And we just have to get it. We have to acknowledge it. And I enjoyed that. Yeah. So there's a lot of visual storytelling in the way you did this. Can you speak on that a little bit?
Yes. You know what? I believe in the power of silence in cinema. You know, the kind of, we have so much noise, so much dialogue, so much music. Mm-hmm. Sometimes if it's earned, if you just have silence and you look at things, there's a moment, it's like a meditation moment where you just go, okay, I get it. I'm catching up now. I can see that in this instance, it was about the landscapes that we'd gone through in the film.
Right.
Depopulated. These boys are no longer. Sorry, spoiler alert. But, you know, it's like the world when they've departed from it. And the other thing I would say, Mike, is my power belief in the importance of nature. You know, nature is a huge thing in art. Most paintings and poems involve nature, and that's because nature enriches the world, but it's also a bystander to our own actions. You know, it witnesses. You know, if you're a tree, you've been there for hundreds of years, you've seen all this history, you stand and you look down on what we're doing. It gives a kind of godliness without it being religious. And I felt that was really important, that we had done this to the world. The First World War was the first time we desecrated the landscape with mass armaments. And we've been doing that ever since. And I think it was almost like a lament to what mankind was actually doing in that moment.
Well, I found it very effective. Now, tell me a little bit about a casting, because you have a terrific cast, and I think Alicia was like a great find, and I can't now picture anybody else in the role. Tell me what you were looking for and how you were able to find her.
Well, we were, you know, I mean, in a way, we had very little to judge her on. I mean, Alicia Vikander had done A Royal Affair, which is a very good Danish film, and she'd also been in Anna Karenina with Keira Knightley, but that was it. You know, those were those two movies, really, we could watch. But when I met her for dinner, you know, she was very keen to have the role, and I sat there and I thought, wow, you really are Vera. I mean, she's formidable, she's determined, centered, focused, quite passionate and emotional, and I thought, these are all the things that Vera is. And she's also very honest about her opinions. Vera. You know, so I think what's important is, although she's not British, you know, I can put the British in an actress. What I can't do is put Vera into her. She has to imbue those qualities herself. And so Alicia was standout to me because of her inherent qualities. She was just Vera.
Well, I have to say, I wonder if you feel fate played a hand, because without giving anything away, I understand originally there was someone else pegged for the role, but
yeah. It
ended up being this, and sometimes it's sort of like a divine accident.
You know, that's true. I always believe, you know, people who perceive something to be really good, it's like an accident. You know, everything has come together.
Right.
I don't think it's the director, by the way, who's responsible for that. He certainly, or she hurt, certainly helped, but repeat, you know, Dickens or Mozart. The rest of us, I'm afraid to say, are just masters of good luck. And in this instance, I think we've experienced that. Thank you, God, for that.
We'll be right back.
And you're tuned to listener-sponsored radio, WBAI 99.5 FM in New York and on the web at WBAI.org. I'm Mike Sargent. You're listening to Night Shift. We've had a series of interviews. That was just an interview with James Kent, who's the director of Testament of Youth, which is in theaters right now. Next, we're going to take a departure from some of the films we've been talking about and talk about the written word and the visual accompaniment. And there's an organization called Writers of the Future. It's started by L. Ron Hubbard, who's a science fiction writer who's known for starting some other things. But Writers of the Future is something that began over 30 years ago, and subsequently the publisher Galaxy Press sponsors this event, and it has really found some of the most powerful and dynamic talent around in science fiction today, both from the illustration end and from, of course, the writing end. I got a chance to talk with John Goodwin, who's the president of Galaxy Press, and he's been involved with book publishing since the mid-80s. And he's very involved. He's the president of the Hollywood Christmas Parade. He's a member of the Explorers Club, the Science Fiction Writers of America, Mystery Writers of America, Western Writers, Dubai Press Club, and all kinds of things. He's a very interesting man. So we got a chance to talk about science fiction publishing, which of course has changed a lot over the years, what the contest is all about, and what is so great about something that helps develop burgeoning and new talent. So stay tuned for an interview with John Goodwin, publisher of Galaxy Press, here on Night Shift. All right, you're tuned to listener-sponsored radio, WBAI, and I'm speaking with the publisher of Galaxy, the Galaxy Press anthology, Writers of the Future, John Goodwin. John, welcome to WBAI.
Thank you very much. It's great to be with you.
All right. So before I get into the contest a little, John, tell me a little bit about you. How did you first fall in love with writing and science fiction and just get involved with all these things that are, at this point, Galaxy Press?
Well, I mean, I think probably any red-blooded American kid at some point or another was just fascinated looking up into the stars in the sky and just, what if? And so I used to like reading the, you know, science fiction stories. I think some of the first, I love the Lensman series, the Doc Smith and I was just like transformed when I found those. And I remember when Star Wars first came out, I probably saw that 10, 15 times. And I remember riding my little Volkswagen car and I was like in a TIE fighter there, you know.
Yeah, right.
I was so transfixed. And so, you know, I got involved with publishing just kind of like because I was somewhat throughout my high school and college years, every year I'd pick a different job, one indoors, one outdoors, because I wanted to learn how to build my own house. So I learned all the various trades. But then inside, I worked all types of different activities, and my sales experience then wound me up in a publishing organization, and there went from sales, marketing, PR, and I've done all the various functions. And in 2002, I was asked to come over and start Galaxy Press, and that's what I've been doing since as the president of Galaxy Press. And there I publish all the fiction works of L. Ron Hubbard, and probably the most known genre he wrote in is science fiction, where he had Battlefield Earth and Mission Earth. But he was also one of the great writers of the of science fiction's golden age under John W. Campbell. And so I've read a lot of those stories, and it's just a real fun thing because the philosophy that he had on science fiction is that it was a herald of possibility, and that's really what the Writers of the Future contest is all about, and that's why I always have such incredible keynote speakers who are astronauts or the engineers that put us onto Mars or onto the moon, and it's just it's almost like living your dream, you know, being able to work in this area that I'm working in.
Well, it definitely sounds like it to me. So now tell me a little bit about the history of the Writers of the Future and how L. Ron Hubbard started it and why.
Well, it's interesting because this year marks the 75th anniversary of his first writing contest when he was an explorer. This is back in 1940. He was his first expedition under the Explorers Club, which is the main headquarters there in New York where you are.
I've been there.
He flew his first flag. He flew there, and he was on an expedition mapping the coastal waters from Oregon up through Ketchikan, Alaska. And he ended up there in Ketchikan. He was there for a few months. And on a radio show he did there called The Mail Boy, he launched a writing contest. and it was called the Golden Pen Award. And that was Christmas time for people to submit Christmas stories. And the only qualifications were that you couldn't have been professionally published already. And then the prizes, he had different prizes, one of which was taking the winner and introducing him to his connections in New York, because he was at that point a very popular writer. So that was kind of like the precursor to 1983. Now we're moving forward to the launch of the Writers of the Future contest. And that started with the express aim of providing a means for aspiring artists for the chance for their works to be seen and acknowledged. And you had some of the most amazing talented writers who came on board to help with the contest at that time, and that helped to make a big difference, because you had the Hubbard, who was already pretty well known, but then you had authors such as Frank Herbert, who obviously wrote Dune, and you had Emma Caffrey, who came on board the second year, but you also had who's still with us now, Robert Silverberg, was in the first judge, and he's been a grandmaster of science fiction. Ted Sturgeon, Jack Williamson, so Roger Zelazny. So there's a lot of these great writers who were the initial judges for the contest, and it's still continued on that tradition now 35 years later. And some of the top writers in science fiction and fantasy have got to start because of this contest, and it's really interesting, because I just we've started this creative writing program, and so I was in Brigham Young University earlier this year, and had brought this to talk about it, and we ended up with a at a writing class there where Brandon Sanderson was a teacher. And so after speaking with him, he said, "Yeah, I entered the contest when I first started. I wrote three short stories in my entire life, and I submitted one, and I was a finalist." He then started writing novels and very much disqualified himself. But right after that, we talked about it, and he's the most recent judge for the contest. Huh. For obviously, he's a brilliant writer. But anyway, so that's how it pretty much got started in '83, and it just continues to grow. And many of the winners are now judges, like Dave Wolverton, Sean Williams. Have gone on Eric Flint, Nina Creaky Hoffman, and some of the, like Kevin Anderson, entered and ended up disqualifying himself, selling professionally before he actually won the contest. But he's been a judge since, 20 years now. And so he also has some of the people, like Todd McCaffrey, took over after his mom passed, and his enemy, Brian Herbert, took over as a judge when his father passed.
Now, it's not just for writers, though, anymore, is it?
No. What happened was, when we first started the contest, we did the thing where we hired artists to illustrate the stories. And it's interesting, even Dave Dorman, who now is very, very well known for his Star Wars art that he created, was one of the artists for the for one of the early books. But based upon the success of the writing contest, we then launched its sister Illustrators of the Future contest 5 years later, and now that's become very, very popular too. And we've got entries now that come in from over 160 countries around the world between both contests, and it's now earned itself that status of being the most effective and prestigious contest for introducing new talent into the world of speculative fiction for both writers and artists. And artists isn't just going into the area of doing cover art or illustration, but he's also got that sequential art, the guys that graphic novels, some guys that do, in fact, one of our judges lives there in New Jersey, Robert Castillo, won the contest, and based on publicity that was created for him after winning the contest, became very, very well known for his doing storyboards, and so he does a lot of storyboards for music videos, and he became a judge after that as well, because he's just so talented. So you can use your art in all types of formats, but the basic concept of the Illustrators of the Future contest is an illustration needs to tell a story visually. So it's still about telling a story, and that's what makes it different than pictures or paintings or other types of art, is that an illustration specific has to tell a story. So whether you go, however you then branch off into further aspects of art, it's still that base that has the illustration and the story combined to make a much stronger communication than just the story or the illustration by itself.
Okay. Well, walk me through it a little bit, because I know there's a big mentoring process. And, you know, let's say, okay, I'm a writer. I'm at home and I'm like, all right, this is a contest. I'll submit my story. Like, what happens? What are the time frames? How does the mentoring work? And how do you end up being part of it?
Sure. Well, the contest runs from October 1st through September 30th every year. So it's four quarters. So it's October 1st, December 31st, and then January 1st, March, April through, I think it's end of June, July through October. And so each one of those three-month periods, a person can submit to enter either the writer contest or the illustrator contest. Now, the thing about the contest is that's open to anyone that's not been professionally published. It's free. There's no entry fee on it. And that's one thing that Mr. Hubbard saw to it in his will, was that part of his legacy is to provide for the continuance of this contest because of the significance of what it does to provide for the future of science fiction and fantasy. So, like I said, there's no entry fee. The writer and the artist maintain full rights to their work, and that's something that's very unique. You'll hear back also within, like after the quarter's over, between 1 or 2 months after the end of the quarter is when you're going to hear back if you won or not, and that's also something that's very unique in contests. And so then once it's established that you've got the, we have the three winners, but we also have finalists, and so everybody will be called or written to until the winners are actually called and told. And then at the end of the year, the 12 writer winners and the 12 illustrator winners are flown out to Hollywood in April for a week-long workshop given by the contest judges. And this is where you've got people like Kevin Anderson or Sean Williams flies in from Australia. We got Rob Sawyer from Canada. Tim Powers, he's a World Fantasy Award winner with what he did in On Stranger Tides, that was made into a movie with Johnny Depp. Larry Niven, all these top writers are the judges, and they give their take on what happened with them to become professional writers. So it's not like this is what you have to do to become a professional writer. You're given the basic tools of writing skills itself, and that there's a series of essays that Mr. Hubbard wrote earlier on that were published in Writer's Digest magazines of the 30s and 40s, because he has a long history of trying to help the aspiring writer. So those are used, and then modern techniques of hard sci-fi, fantasy, if you only write the fast, or if you write the long deliberate, different ideas of how to put stories together, how to research. And so all these different judges who are speakers talk about their particular technique and what they do. And so this enables the winners to have, they can go whichever way they want to go. And we also have lectures like Kevin Anderson and Rebecca Mess to give a lecture on the business of writing. So it's not just how you write, but also when do you quit your day job? How do you have to go? What's the economics of a writing business, and what's the economics of an art business? So that week long, they get all that stuff. And then usually the night before the event is when we have the great reveal, the grand reveal, where we have the illustrator. And then yes, they meet who their artist was for the first time.
That's kind of fun.
It's really fun, and it's quite emotional too when the writer sees somebody else's visualization of their story, and it's a real validation to them on that they did something, that it's happened. And then the next day they go to the printer, and they actually see the books coming off the press. And then the next day is we have the award ceremony. So it's quite exciting how that whole thing gets put together. And in addition to all their prize money they get, and the two grand prize winners for the writer and illustrator each receive checks for $5,000. But the award ceremony is a serious black tie gala affair with usually well over 1,000 people in attendance or on the internet watching the live broadcast. And the whole thing on it is that we want to acknowledge them as, these guys are brilliant writers and artists. And so one thing that a person is guaranteed is if they like science fiction and fantasy, this is the book to go to find out, you know, who you're going to be reading 10, 15 years down the road as a brilliant writer of science fiction. And for anybody who's an aspiring writer and artist, this is what the quality you have to be in order to make the grade to becoming professional. So the judges, one for one, will say, make sure you get the book and read it, because that lets you know what how good you have to be to qualify as professional, because that's what these guys are. And so whether you like science fiction or fantasy, I can promise you that you're going to find something in there that you like that will be appropriate for you. Library Journal just came out and gave it a starred review for volume 31, because it was such a great book. So that's the first time we've gotten a starred review from Library Journal, which is quite an honor.
Wow. Well, now let me ask you two part question. One, how big is the publishing run? How many people actually, you know, if you're a writer, how many people does it actually reach? And two, how has publishing changed? I mean, do you have a digital version of these things now? Talk to me a little bit.
Sure. Well, we have the books are available like it in Barnes & Noble and Books A Million and where we find paperbacks. We've done, by the end of this release, because we're still in the first month of release, we will have done 50 bookstore signings across the United States.
Wow.
And so we do these bookstore signings, and the bookstore managers are quite happy because they're selling, you know, 15, 20 books per signing, which they said this is amazing for a first-time author to get that type of sale. So it's that in itself is its own indicator of how popular this is. So we are moving into the e-books is a big deal. We did create 2 years ago, we started making this into a trade paperback.
Right.
So it's the larger format, so that enables us in the back of the book now to have what used to be only the color, be the black and white illustrations that go with the story, which is still in there, but in the back of the book now we have color plates of each of the art pieces, and it's just you realize how brilliant these artists are when you actually look at the color renditions of the story illustration, not just the black and white that's in the book itself. So the book makes it a real treat. And this year the book cover was done by contest judge Bob Eggleton, who's I think won 8 or 9 Hugos. He's just an amazing artist, and he lives near you there in Rhode Island. You may or may not know Bob Eggleton, but he's
I know Bob Eggleton for many years, of course.
Okay, good. Yeah, he's just he's all things Godzilla. Godzilla.
Yes. I understand. And he taught you how to pronounce it correctly.
Exactly.
I understand.
But anyway, and actually in the art, because you've seen the book, right? We sent you the PDF of it.
Yes, I did, yes.
Yeah, so that art, he's the one that art directed the artwork in the book, too, with the illustrators, which was just, he is such a talented artist. So it was a real pleasure for these artists, too, to have some real professional art direction with what you're doing to illustrate these stories. But the thing with this book now, because of the change in the constant evolution of publishing now, with social media has a lot to do with it. And one thing we are very much using to our advantage is we've got 24 winners, and so they've all been activated to contact and through the use of social media. We're really getting the word out. So we have our base that we have here at Galaxy Press of people that we can reach out to, but they each have their own circles as well, which we're using to expand it. So the sales of this book are doing well. It's been repeatedly on the top 5, top 10 of Amazon.com science fiction anthologies and fantasy anthologies. But we're also working to, you know, we'll see what happens this coming week at Barnes & Noble. We're continuing to do events, and so we're anticipating that by sometime, as we continue to build it, by the early part of June, we'll be up on hitting some of the national bestseller list because of this momentum that we're building up with our writers. But one of the main things is just like what we're doing right now, we're talking, you know, the people are listening to this. If you guys like good science fiction fantasy, check it out. You know, they're brilliant writers, and short fiction is definitely on the return, it's on the major upswing right now. And it's amazing. These guys aren't stuck with this. I have to write a certain type of story, like what happens when you become an established author. You know, people know you for this type of a story. These guys don't have that. So it's just, they're totally fresh, and it's just amazing takes on different types of storytelling.
Now, one of the other things that's kind of fascinating about this is, like you said, that it's become sort of it's a launching ground for for these writers. Why is this, if you're someone who wants to get out there, why is this better than, let's say, self-publishing, as a lot of people have been doing?
Well, the thing with self-publishing, and what happens with self-publishing, is that you hear the one or two success stories and you go, wow, that's the way to go. But that's one or two success stories out of, what, 200,000 people that are going after it?
Right.
And so here you've got the 12 writers, and we have one published finalist as well. So because, you know, sometimes we'll add another story or two in there to fill out the book to make sure it's big enough. Because the other thing, too, just which I didn't say, this is strictly merit competition as you win the contest. So all the judges, when they do their judging overseas, is the story or the art and a number. They have no idea if you're male, female, age, nationality, anything. So when it comes back to us, we take out the number and find out what the name is and where they're from, and that's who the authors are for the story. So sometimes we'll also include one or two finalists, like to make sure that the book is somewhat consistent in size.
Gotcha. That's interesting. Now, this whole process, it seems to me, after at this point, you've kind of got it down to a science. You've been doing it. So for you now, what is your job? What do you end up doing? What do you love about what you do?
Talking to you. one of the things I do is I do a... I work on, as a president, I do a lot of stuff just to make sure I get the word out is a big thing that I do. So I do a lot of radio, some TV, but mostly radio, because it gets me able to talk. Because when I'm able to actually have a chance to just chat and answer the questions, and what about this and what about that, that's when I find it works out the best. But I also work with all of our winners and drill them on how to do radio and TV. So we've had... 6 TV shows from our winners so far, and we have more scheduled.
Okay.
And he said, you know, I can honestly say I wouldn't be where I am today if that wasn't for the Rise of the Future contest. And obviously his first book in the Wise Men Fear trilogy, I think is what it is, or...
Mm-hmm.
It came out in New York Times in the New York Times bestseller list, and then the second book when it came out debuted number one in New York Times.
Yes,
and, he's like you said, he couldn't do anything. Nobody would take his book, and so someone said, "Well, enter the Rise of the Future contest." So he took one of the chapters and entered that as his own complete short story, and he won the contest. And Kevin Anderson is one who actually took him under his wing and introduced him to his agent. And that's kind of like how it moved forward with him. So several of the writers will be taken in with their with a judge who just really likes him. And so you got someone who is like Mike Resnick has published many of our winners, and same thing with Orson Scott Card in his online magazine. They've taken our winners and they work with him a lot, and Kevin Anderson, the same thing, works with a lot of our winners and his word fire. So it tends to grow, and these guys are very they get that opportunity, but because they're so talented and they learn the ropes of how you do, you know, survive in the publishing environment, they're going to make it a lot better. And the stats are that probably about 60% go on to successful publishing careers as winners of the contest, whereas in self-publishing, you hear the big success stories, you know, but you take a look at that, what's that percentage, and it's like less than 1%, it's a quarter of a percent. So it's, you know, if you go for this and can actually make the grade, editors also know that. I mean, we have people almost every year when they'll send a story saying, like, you know, I entered the contest, and as a winner, I switched my pitch letter, and I resent out the same story without editing it, and it was sold, just because they can say now that they're a winner of the contest, and they don't have the that stigma of, like, who is this person? Can we trust them? Whereas because they've won the contest, they make it all the way through. Tom Doherty, the publisher of Tor, came out this year, and he received the L. Ron Hubbard Lifetime Achievement Award. And it was funny, when I was first talking about it, he said, I publish him. He totally knows our winners, because he publishes most of them.
Wow. Well, now, I'm also curious, just only because it stood out to me what you were saying about L. Ron Hubbard was a member of the Explorers Club, and you're a member of the Explorers Club.
Right.
What do you think the connection between writing speculative fiction and, I guess, what the Explorers Club is all about? How and why do you think those two things kind of go hand in hand?
Well, the whole thing of like, even why Mr. Hubbard was brought into writing science fiction in the first place, as much as what I said, like, I totally enjoyed the Lensman series and the Skylark series, up to the point of the golden age of science fiction had pretty much been the fast rocket ships, the ray guns, the robots, and what was done was the publishers of Street and Smith pulled in some of the successful adventure writers at that time. This is in the late 30s, early 40s. That we're going to revive Astounding Science Fiction, and we need to bring people into science fiction. And so their job was, and Campbell was given the express direction to take what these authors write and publish it, because it needed to get out of that very much super niche mold of just the ray guns and robots and into being humanized or people. And so that's what the advantage of, because he was such an accomplished explorer and adventurer, he knew people from all over the world, and so he was able to add that component to storytelling, then to science fiction and fantasy, and make something that people could actually relate to, and they could be that person, or they could relate to that scenario and see that as a very, I guess, plausible future scene. Or if you're looking from the back, you know, this is what happened that got us up to this point.
Right.
And that's by adding the understanding and the reality of what people are really like, it makes it for a much better read that people can identify with. Because that's one of the things too, you know, people would like, you had a rocket scientist that loves science fiction, but then the average person wouldn't necessarily get into it. But then by adding how a regular person, the people personality into a story, all of a sudden the genre could open up to a lot more people to be able to appreciate that. And that's I think what made it so successful and why it's so important specifically that genre, because he invested in that genre even in, you know, after his passing, because like I said, he saw science fiction as a herald of possibility. And I've had various discussions and arguments with historians, science fiction historians, about like there's two directions of science fiction. You've got the Mary Shelley with Frankenstein and that science fiction and advancement of science can lead to man's destruction. And you got like Heinlein and Hubbard and those types that saw it as really as a herald of possibility, and it could be for a brighter future. You know, if man handles it properly, then it could lead to a real prosperity. And so that's kind of like two different prongs of science fiction. So what we do with Rise of Futures help to forward that one as the herald of possibility. And that's why you've got, like, this year, William Pomerantz, who's the vice president of Virgin Galactic for Special Projects, was a keynote speaker talking about, you know, Virgin Galactic's projects and their space station and going into space and privatizing and making it possible for the average person to actually go into space. We've had engineers, astronauts, we've all spoken that their inspiration was reading science fiction that makes them want to, like, how can we go further? How can we get to Mars? What can we do on Mars? Where is their life? All these things are questions they're trying to get answered, but their inspiration was science fiction.
Gotcha. And now, what the website to find out about the concepts for both the writing and the illustration or painting is the same website?
Yes, it's writersofthefuture.com, and you can go there and you can find out. You can actually watch, you can go online and watch the awards ceremony. You can see William Pomerantz's speech, and you can see the awards being presented in their various speeches. And you'll see obviously what the book is. You can get, you know, find your copy of the book there. But it's writersofthefuture.com to be able to find out more about the contest, how to enter the contest. But more importantly, I really mean it, you know, check out the book if you like science fiction and fantasy. And looking through your site, I mean, you're all about that. It's a great place to go and find out some really cool new writers that you're going to really enjoy reading, which is what Library Journal just said. Right now, we're probably about 220 different book reviews that you're going to find on Amazon.com and Goodreads and stuff like that. Just we've never had so many reviews of a book. So, and it's growing by like 15, 20 every week. So it's we know we've got something good going here. So I highly recommend people to check out it because it really is a good story.
John Goodwin, I thank you now. How far along? So you've just begun what will end up being the next year's contest, correct?
Correct. The contest actually just started. It ends September 31st. September 30th and starts October 1st. So now we're into, we're actually halfway through volume 32. It's just, you know, we released, we had our award ceremony in the middle of April, and then the book officially released a few weeks ago here in May. And so, because once, when they finished the contest, all the judging and then going through and deciding who the grand prize winners are and doing the final edits, typesetting, and we also have to give time, because you have your winning artists, but they are, they win the contest based on three pieces of art that they submit. They then are given a story that they have to read, and they have to illustrate the story, and that's what gets published in the book. And it's off of that illustration that the judge determines who's the grand prize winner for the illustrator contest. So that all has this timeline. You know, they get sent the story. They have a month to read it and do their art. So by and getting it printed by, like I said, beginning of April is we're working pretty fast to pull that whole thing off to get it ready. So we're halfway through, but it's one of those things too. If a person is an aspiring writer or artist, submit your work. You know, that's just, you do that. If you miss the deadline for this quarter, the next quarter starts, and once volume 32 is done, volume 33 is starting. It's Mr. Hubbard remains one of the best paid artists, one of the best paid writers on the planet still today. So this contest will be going for long past me. You know, it's just going to continue going on and on and on.
I'm just curious of the people who submit and potentially the winners, how many of them are like new, young, up and coming writers, and how many of them are people who may have had completely different careers but have always wanted to write it and end up taking that chance?
That's actually a really good question, because this year the grand prize winner just turned 60.
Wow.
Last week.
Wow.
So it's so literally is one time I remember a few years ago we had. And I could tell it was a doctor based on the story. I didn't know it because at that time it was still just a number. But it was a doctor, and he worked the graveyard emergency room shift in Chicago, emergency rooms. So that's one of the gnarliest of any type of aspect of medical profession. And so when he came out, when he was, he said he tried becoming a writer when he was a kid and failed miserably, so he became a doctor. And then he said, I'm going to give it another shot. So he did. So he was like, also in his, he's probably late 50s that he won. But like I said, this, the girl that just won this year, the grand prize winner, has had a very successful year, career in various things, including the technical field. And then decided she wanted to go back to being a writer and gave it a shot and won. So we have winners range from the writing contest. Pretty much the youngest is around 20, 21. They have to learn how to master grammar. I mean, that's just you write and write and write until you really get the hang of grammar. And that's why it's really important to read these books, so you can get ideas of how other people handle different different tools and techniques. How do you handle suspense in science fiction? How do you introduce new characters? How do you deal with technology that doesn't exist? How do you describe it to make it seem realistic so somebody can believe it? They're willing to suspend disbelief. And then, so then by having that, having read and just written and written and written, usually by like 20 or 21, a person's got a mastery of the language that they can start winning the contest. Artists, they're a bit younger, so I mean, we had artists who have had careers already in other areas that wanted to get back to it, but that we've had people as young as seniors in high school win the contest. They're just amazingly, they've been drawing since they have access to crayons and a white wall in their bedroom. You know, that they've been doing stuff. So, but it's pretty much open to anybody, and because of the fact it's by merit alone that a person wins, they are, we have no idea. You know, sometimes in publishing, you know, publisher won't take somebody if they're over a certain age because they don't want to get sick with somebody too late in their life.
Right.
That's not our thing at all. It's strictly by merit you're going to win. So if a story's good enough and you win, then last year we had the highest, we had somebody that was 8 years old enter the illustrating contest, and someone was 101 years old enter the writing contest.
Wow.
That's... So it's open to anybody. The whole idea is we really want to celebrate the arts, the importance of the arts. And in today's society, with the budget cuts and taking this stuff out of the curriculum in schools, all the more important to have an outlet for aspiring writers and artists to submit and have a chance for their creative efforts to be seen.
Now, just for the benefit of those who've never seen it, how many new writers are in each volume? And you also have some veteran writers submit what I assume are new stories as well?
Well, what we have is each year there are 12 winners that get published and 12 artists that are published. We also have, like I said, one or two finalists who we publish, and they're still eligible to enter the contest again. And then we have we have other finalists who aren't published, but by being able to say that they are published finalists on their pitch letters, on their resumes, their work is now also taken out of the slush pile because of the popularity and street cred that they get from this contest. So every year being published, it's minimally the 12 winners, sometimes another one or two finalists. And then we implemented last year taking stories from our judges and publishing what would you have submitted had you been entering the contest. So this year we had a story from Kevin Anderson, Rebecca Mesta, and Larry Niven submitted a short story. And the year before that, we had Orson Scott Card did one of his, and Mike Resnick. And then we also have a short story from Hubbard that he wrote when he was also writing science fiction back in the 40s. So we've got those stories as well as the winning stories.
Wow. All right. Well, the website is writersofthefuture.com, and you're John Goodwin. You've been with the company for how long now, since the beginning?
The beginning, since 2002. So that's this is my lucky year, number 13.
All right. Well, John Goodwin, I thank you for your time, and I thank you for the generosity of some of these books we'll be able to give away for donation and whatnot, and hopefully I'll get to speak to you again.
That'd be great. I very much love that. Thank you very much, Mike.
All right. Thanks, man.
Thank you. that somebody dragged me with me.
Still tuned to Listener Sponsored Radio, WBAI 99.5 FM. We were listening to an interview with John Goodwin, publisher of Galaxy Press and overseer of the Writers of the Future and Artists of the Future contest that goes on regularly. You can go online and look that up, and if you think you've got the goods, you should submit some work. So next, we spoke earlier with the director of a film called Testament of Youth, which is a woman's coming of age. There's another coming of age story called I Believe in Unicorns. It's in limited release in theaters now, and it's by a writer-director named Leah Meyerhoff. And it's about a young woman who sort of fantasizes, has a very active fantasy life, and does almost unicorns and thinks this kind of local bad boy is going to be her Prince Charming. It's a very realistic and interesting point of view. It's another female-centric film, and definitely about that first time, first love, first kiss, first time, first entry into your sexuality, all of those things, and what that's about, and the heartbreak of it as well. So it's a really actually interesting well-made film, and of course I got a chance to talk with Leah about filmmaking, doing what she's doing, why she wanted to make this film, and of course when she first knew she wanted to be a storyteller.
Welcome to the future. It's just like the present, but more fucked up.
You're tuned to listener-sponsored radio, WBAI, and I'm speaking with Leah Myroff, who is the writer, director, and I believe producer of I Believe in Unicorns. Leah, welcome to WBAI.
Thanks for having me.
So my first question to you, Leah, is when did you first know you wanted to be a storyteller?
I always have been a storyteller, but I didn't realize that I wanted to be a filmmaker until college. I went to school at Brown University and took a few film classes at a local art school nearby, RISD, and discovered filmmaking then.
And what is it about film that makes you feel like this is the medium for you to talk in?
I think film is a language of dreams in a lot of ways, and film also is, I think, the best tool to really tap into this kind of collective unconscious. And it's a way of, you know, it's this beautiful ritual that we do. We get together in a dark room with strangers and watch a story unfold on screen and live in someone else's shoes for that hour and a half. I think film is a real tool for empathy in a way, and it's a way to allow us a window into someone else's story. And I knew that I wanted to be a filmmaker and make this specific film for my first feature film to tell a story about an authentic, imaginative, dreamy teenage girl. I think it's very rare to see films with female protagonists, and especially female protagonists with an interior fantasy life. And I wanted to create that kind of film.
Well, I agree. Now, let me ask you, in terms of your approach, one of the things that really stood out to me is you have a lot of textures to this, a lot of layers, which I guess in some ways, echo the layers of the protagonist, and you shot in different film stocks. What was your thinking there, and what was the intent?
Yeah, so I Believe in Unicorns is a really subjective story from the viewpoint of this 16-year-old girl named Davina, who is an artist and a dreamer and navigating the complexities of her reality through escaping into a fantasy world. And so all of the aesthetic decisions were made with that in mind, including the decision to shoot primarily on Super 16mm film and also some just straight 16mm film and some Super 8mm film. We did extensive stop-motion puppet animation on 16mm film, which for any animators out there is probably the hardest possible thing you can do. It's essentially animating blind. And the idea was to create a world that could have come out of the mind of this character. We wanted to create a really handcrafted, collage, textured look for the film, as if you can almost see this girl's fingerprints on the edge of the frame. And so all of the aesthetic decisions really come from her interior world.
And now, what was, I know that this is semi-autobiographical, but what was the impetus for wanting to tell this story, and what were some of the key things you wanted to bring out in a story like this?
I wanted to create a film that my 16-year-old self would have loved to have seen. So when I was growing up, you know, I remember sneaking into the art house cinemas and seeing work by Alison Anders and Kim Pierce and Jane Campion and some fantastic filmmakers that really opened my eyes to other worlds that were out there. But there weren't that many female characters that I could relate to on screen. And so for this film, I wanted to create a character that felt real and relatable and had this complex interior fantasy life. And with that in mind, I cast Natalia Dyer, who was 16 at the time of filming and was a junior in high school, and we collaborated quite closely on the character. The script comes from elements of my own life as well as elements from her experience being a teenager now. And the most autobiographical component is the mother character in the film. So the mother character is played by my actual mother in real life. And my mother, Toni Meyerhoff, is disabled. She has MS and has been in a wheelchair as long as I can remember. When I was writing the script, that just naturally worked its way into the story, this idea of a girl who's grown up rather quickly being the sole caretaker in her house and what happens when there is this mother-daughter role reversal and a child grows up fast. What that, you know, in the case of this film and in my own life, it led to this desire for escape and running away with an older boy and thinking that maybe this is the escape from her reality that she's been looking for. So that's kind of the most personal element in the film. But I also think the lead character of Davina is someone that I relate to, and that, you know, thousands of other teenage girls have related to. I've been traveling the festival circuit for the past year, and it's been incredible to connect with a younger female audience who's just hungry for stories that portray a reflection of their own lives on screen.
Well, you're maybe going to answer my next question. What was the most difficult part of making this, and what's been the most rewarding?
The most difficult part of making this film was working with, you know, first time, you know, Davina was 16 when we filmed, and this was her first feature film. And that led to a bunch of just logistical challenges. If you're working with an underage actress, you have limited time on set,
sure,
and so forth. But it's also one of the most rewarding elements of the film. I think her character, being actually 16 at the time of shooting, she brought a level of authenticity to the character and to the film and her way of seeing the world that really comes through on screen. And I'm most proud of having created a film that other people see and connect with this character and say, I've not seen a film like this ever before. On a technical level, you know, shooting on 16 millimeter and doing stop motion animation was a very ambitious task for a first feature. But again, those are some of my favorite moments in the film, is these magical, magical creations.
Well, I think you did a very, and I'll just admit to you, I watched it with my teenage daughter, and she was literally talking to the screen.
I've heard of a film and then come back the next day and bring their parents and say, look, I really need you to see this film so you understand more about how I see the world. And that makes
sure
me smile.
Well, I also believe that as you define your art defines you. What did you learn about yourself in the making of this film?
Oh, that's a fantastic question. You know, in many ways, this film is a sort of self-portrait. In the same way that the character, that Davina's character in the film is a photographer, and she's constantly taking Polaroids and photographs as a way of slowing down time and looking at, you know, like when her world gets too overwhelming, she'll take a photograph of it, and that's almost an entry point into understanding the world. In the same way, the making of this film is like a self-portrait for my own life. It's a way that I have understood more about my own memories of being a teenage girl and also just the way that I see the world. I think I have a very unique vision, and it comes through on screen.
Okay.
Is that your daughter in the background?
Yes, she is. I'm just trying to shush her because she's making noise now while I'm recording this. Sorry about that. Well, that's pretty fascinating. And I'm also, you know, in some ways it seems that the making of this film, you know, and then working with another 16-year-old, kind of, it all kind of comes full circle. It's autobiographical, but you're also to tap into the universal things that, that all girls and probably human beings can relate to, just about growing up and figuring out who you are sometimes through the relationships you have with others.
Yeah, I mean, those. I think all of us have a memory of the first time we fell in love. And those first relationships are messy, and they're complicated, and they're confusing, and they're overwhelming. And this film really taps into that visceral feeling of falling so madly in love with someone that you're just in over your head, and you're just along for the journey, even if maybe the person you're in love with, you know, you might know better. It might not be the right relationship to be in. It's just, you make these decisions impulsively and just go for it. And I think that's a universal experience.
Well, let me ask you, there's been a lot of talk, and, you know, if you knew me, you'd know this is partially my milieu, but there's been a lot of talk about the paucity of women filmmakers, the opportunities for them, the films, you know, with protagonists for women. What was your experience in making this film and then releasing it? Like you said, seeing that there is a hunger for films that women can't, specifically can relate to.
I think there are, you know, and I think it's great that there's that it's getting more attention in the press these days, but there are very few female directors in this industry.
Yes.
I think the statistics are of the top 100 grossing Hollywood films, less than 2% were directed by women.
Yes.
And for me, there, you know, for me, it was deciding to become a filmmaker. It didn't really become an option for me until I saw other female directors come before me. And Alison Anders in particular was quite instrumental. I saw her work early on and said, oh, this is an option for me. Women can be directors too. And I reached out to her the script, and she ended up becoming an executive producer on I Believe in Unicorns and has been a real mentor along the way. And I think I knew it would be challenging, not just being a female director, but telling a story with a female protagonist. I think the Gina Davis Film Institute recently did a study that less than 30% of the speaking characters on screen are women. So we're just so enmeshed in a world that's of films made by men and about men that we forget that women are half the population. And as a female director, you know, I've never forgotten that. And that's been a real motivating force in wanting to become a filmmaker in the first place. I want to contribute to the cultural conversation and create more female characters on screen, because I think audiences are bored of seeing the same film over and over. They want to see a diversity of perspectives. And this film has shown me that there are hundreds of thousands of people out there excited for films from a new perspective, and specifically from a female perspective. In addition to being a director, I'm also the founder of a female filmmaker collective called Film Fatales, which is a network of feature female directors who get together every month, and we support each other and collaborate on projects and build a community to make our films. And we're actually, during the New York theatrical run of I Believe in Unicorns here at IFC Center, we're doing filmmaker discussions every night following the evening screenings with other members of that collective. You know, this weekend we have Mary Harron, who directed American Psycho and the notorious Betty Page. And we have Nicole Cassell, who did The Woodsman. Now she's directing The Killing. And Reed Morano, who's a fantastic cinematographer and just directed her first feature film, Meadowland. And so there are dozens of women directors out there making films. They just need access to the same financial resources and opportunities that their male counterparts have.
Well, I can tell you I agree with you 1,000%, and as a filmmaker of color, I have similar feelings.
Yes.
So now let me ask you also, and 'cause you already answered the question I was going to ask you about Femme Fatales, you know, what, having made this film, and you were talking about what you learned about yourself, has that in any ways strengthened or made clear what kind of, you know, path you want to take as a filmmaker?
Yeah, having made this film has actually strengthened my resolve to continue to make films with female protagonists. I think often women directors and people of color, or at least from my own perspective, not seeing our voice, my voice represented on screen motivates me that much more to tell my stories. And
amen.
I hope to continue to do that for a long time to come.
Well, I definitely hope I can get to talk to you every time you do make one. Now, let me ask you another question. This is probably a little more personal than anything I'm going to ask you, only
sure.
Because I'm actually working on a documentary that touches upon this, and I'd love to maybe talk with you after this and maybe interview you for that. But why do you think young girls are so attracted to bad boys?
Ooh, that's a complex question. I think I can only really speak to my own experience. I can't
sure.
really speak for all young girls. But in my case, I grew up with this unusual childhood of having grown up relatively quickly, taking care of my mother from when I was 7 years old on, and really was looking for an escape and looking for someone to take care of me and looking for this childhood I never really got to have. And I found that through relationships with older men who often I knew were not right. It wasn't the healthiest of relationships, but it's someone paying attention and caring, and it feels adventurous and exciting. And I think, you know, that happens often, not just with young women. I think every one of us can probably think of one relationship in our past that was messy and complicated and that we've grown from and learned from. And I think it's a rite of passage. It's something that we go through, that sometimes there are two people who are both good people. They're just bad for each other. And I think, again, in this film, without giving too much away, but I really was hoping to explore some of those complexities that happen in relationships, and particularly often in first relationships, when you have two people who aren't quite right for each other but are desperately trying to make it work, and the lengths that people will go to feel loved and to feel wanted.
Well, I definitely
are messy.
Think I think you did, and I'll have to say that one of the things I enjoyed about your film as a male was that, you know, you gave me a sense of why this character, why he was so attracted to her, too, and what was missing in him, which, you know, as, you know, very often when a male writes a female character, there's not that much depth. So tell me a little bit about creating well-balanced and well-rounded characters.
Thank you for saying that. That's something we worked a lot on. I worked with both actors to create believable backstories for their characters, and we really wanted it to be a balanced relationship in the sense that neither the male or female character in the story are bad people, but they are just bad for each other, and they both are looking to fill a need that they have in each other. It's often what I think happens in broken relationships or in messier relationships, as both people come into the relationship hoping that the other person is going to satisfy some need in them. When really, for a healthy relationship, it's when two people who are fully formed come together and the relationship exists where their own individual identities overlap. But in this film, we wanted Sterling, the male character, we wanted him to be... He's exciting, and he's volatile, and he's, you know, adventurous, and we understand why she falls for him. But at the same time, she fulfills this need in him. He has never really allowed himself to be in love, even though he's older than she is. In many ways, he's less mature. And being with her kind of allows him into this vulnerable space that he hasn't allowed himself to be in before. And some of his volatility and anger and aggression comes from letting his guard down and letting her in.
I concur, and I think you did a great job with that. And, you know, I know that guy. I've met that guy, you know, as well as knowing her and even relating.
We've all been in these relationships at some point or another and learned from them. Yeah.
Now, for you, in terms of as a filmmaker, who would you say, you know, you were mentioning a few of your influences, Alison Anders, who's a great filmmaker, and I definitely caught a slight homage to Badlands there. Who are some of the filmmakers, and what are the kinds of films, the kinds of stories you love and you would love to tell?
I mean, Alison Anders for sure, Terrence Malick, Jane Campion, Kimberly Pierce. Fish Tank was another influence. There's another small independent film by a filmmaker from my collective named Eliza Hittman, and her film is called It Felt Like Love, which was a strong influence on this film. I'm most drawn to stories that feel intimate and personal and real and show me a perspective that I haven't seen before. So that can fall into the category of, you know, Kelly Reichardt's work and some of these very, you know, intimate character studies, and also falls into the category of magical realism. You know, I also love Fantastic Mr. Fox and Hedwig and the Angry Inch and some of these larger set piece type films. And I think I Believe in Unicorns brings together both of those elements and interests in that it's a world in which social realism overlaps with magical realism to create a new perspective on this sort of coming of age road trip movie.
Well, let me ask you a couple of contextual questions here before they make me go. Why do you think we as human beings need to tell stories? Why do you think it's part of every culture?
Oh, you have great questions. I think we are inherently storytellers. I think whether it's sitting around a campfire telling stories or whether it's watching films unfold on screen, storytelling is a way that we can communicate with each other. Film in particular... It's a way for a filmmaker to take something that's interior and they're, you know, they're opening up their heart and their mind and putting something on screen and sharing it in a very intimate, direct, visceral way with strangers. And it taps into this kind of collective unconscious, you know, for lack of a better term. I think it's in watching films and in telling stories, it gives us a template for how we navigate the world and ways that we relate to other people around us. And filmmaking, what's most exciting for me about film in particular as a vehicle for storytelling is it's this real tool for empathy. It's an opportunity for an audience member to watch another person's story unfold and put themselves in their shoes and watch the world from their perspective for that hour and a half. And in doing so, learn something about themselves and also about the world around them. And that's why it's so vital that we have a diversity of characters on screen. I think if all we're watching is comic book movie after comic book movie of straight, white, able-bodied men, that's a disservice to our culture. If we can see diversity of perspectives on screen, we'll learn to relate with a diversity of characters, which will make us more empathetic human beings in the world around us every day.
Wow, Leah, I so wish I got to meet you. But I reached out to you on Facebook, so hopefully we can be Facebook friends. And I guess my last question is, what advice do you give to young girls, not unlike my daughter, who are looking to make films, looking to tell stories, looking to make a difference and hopefully change some perspectives?
I love inspiring young women to become filmmakers. It's kind of a passion of mine. My advice is to not give up and to just push forward. Filmmaking is hard. I'm not going to sugarcoat it. Filmmaking is hard. Being a director is hard. Being a female director is even harder. Female director of color, even harder. You know, you can keep adding on to that. But if you have a vision and a story you want to tell, just no matter what, tell that story, whether you're making a movie on your iPhone or whether you're shooting on 16-millimeter film. Don't give up and surround yourself with a community. Filmmaking is a collective endeavor, and the more that you can have a partner, whether it's a writing partner or a producing partner or a collective like Film Fatales, it makes you that much stronger. So for any young aspiring filmmaker who lives in New York City, they're welcome to join our collective, Film Fatales. And for those who don't live in New York or L.A. or London or some of the other cities we have chapters in, I advise them to start their own group of other like-minded filmmakers who can support them in telling their stories.
Our last interview for the evening is with Paul Bernan, who is one half of Bernan Later Productions. He and Sam Slater started this independent production company to do what they call relationship stories with a comedic element. Their first film was a film in 2013 called Drinking Buddies, and now they've got two films that came out this year. One is called Adult Beginners, and another one that just recently came out called Results. They've got quite an interesting mix of talent, and they definitely have made their mark, because the films they've done so far, everything I've seen, is very well done. So I get a chance to talk to him about why he wanted to be in this business, what their vision is, and a bit more. All right, you tuned to listener-sponsored radio, WBAI, and I'm speaking to producer Paul Bernan, who has a new film out called Results. Paul, welcome to WBAI.
Thanks for having me.
So, Paul, here's my first question to you. Since I consider it all storytelling and you're involved in it, when did you first know you wanted to be involved in storytelling?
Oh, gosh. I think I first knew I wanted to be involved probably 9 or 10 years old, was running around with a camcorder with some friends making SNL-type short videos, Wayne's World-type videos, and my interest only grew from there.
Okay. And just a couple more contextual questions like that. In your estimation, why do you think we as human beings need to tell stories?
That's a great question. I think that so much happens to us on a daily basis. We're processing so much information and so many things going on around us that I think it would almost be, you know, to keep it all inside would be almost crippling. We feel like we have to, we need outlets. We need to tell other people of great things we've seen, of sad things we've seen. I think that's helpful to us to grow as individuals and as people.
Okay, and then my last question like that is, in your estimation, what, and maybe you want to say for your production company, but what makes a good story and a story worth telling?
Yeah, I think a good, for us, we're drawn to material that we can identify with. You know, I think there are very many films that I love that are sci-fi or horror or, you know, other genres that I can't necessarily identify with. But for us as a company at Bernan Later, my partner Sam Slater and I, we make films that we can identify with. So Drinking Buddies, I'm 37. I remember being in my 20s and, you know, not being in love with a job or just figuring out and feeling out relationships. And then fast-forwarding to Adult Beginners, which came out in April, I remember, you know, having a first child and having a lot of friends that didn't have kids yet, and navigating those relationships. And then with results, certainly, you know, try to get to the gym as much as possible. So it's a challenge to keep in shape. And I'm watching, as all of us are, this, you know, self-improvement culture, and the idea people struggling with the notion that they can go out and sort of outsource their own personal and physical health.
Well, you know, it's interesting because I've liked everything you guys have put out. And what, you know, they say drama is a clash of, you know, ideas or principles. But in a lot of ways, the dramas that you guys are making have a lot more to do with philosophies, life philosophies. That's where the clash comes in, and that's where the connection comes in. Does that make sense to you?
It does. I mean, I think it does make sense to us. And I think, you know, sometimes it's on more of a micro level, and sometimes it's more of a macro level. But I think all of our movies, which we like to define as, if people ask what genre we're doing, we like to sort of rephrase the question and say we're making relationship movies with a comedic element. You know, I guess we're making dramedies, but they're really about the human condition and how we're all interacting with each other in different relationships.
Well, I kind of think that life is a dramedy. But, well, one of the things I feel about comedy, I can liken it to science fiction, is that comedy allows us to, again, look at the human condition or learn lessons that don't hit you over the head because it's, you know, it's wrapped in something else. Would you agree with that? And do you feel that's part of why you're drawn to making comedies?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I think I like to, you know, my favorite genre is comedy, just because I view film, for me, I think film is escapism. And when I watch a feature-length film, even much more than television, which I'm very guilty of watching with a second screen, I think for film, I really like to try to really focus on being in the moment in the film. And I think for escapism, my preferred genre is comedy, because I just like to go in there and laugh and let off some steam. I'm attracted to powerful films as well, but I think for us to try to make someone laugh and do it in a way that they're identifying with the characters is the ultimate win-win.
Hmm. Well, now what's interesting about what you guys do is your films, your narrative films, are, as you said, these dramas with or relationship dramas with a comedic element. But the documentaries that you guys have been involved in are on very serious social issues. Explain to me that contrast and maybe how that works in terms of your overall philosophy for Burn Later.
Sure. So we are really a narrative, a feature company, Burn Later. But I got involved in one documentary, Best Kept Secret, which is a story about a group of students that are aging out of the Newark school system that all have it. Developmental disabilities, specifically autism, and it's something very near and dear to my heart because I have a brother, a younger brother, who has autism as well as Williams syndrome, which is somewhat similar to Down syndrome. It's a very personal story for me. It was something I found the director and one of the producers, online on Kickstarter. I was looking for projects when I was just starting off as a producer a couple of years ago, and I was compelled to the story and you know, got in touch with them and helped them raise some finishing funds and introduce them to some other people and help them with sales and marketing. I love documentaries. I love watching documentaries. It's harder for us to monetize documentaries.
Sure.
And we've certainly stayed in the feature narrative business, but fiction, but I think that's the Best Kept Secret documentary is as powerful as a story as I've ever told. And I think, you know, was fortunate enough to win the film was fortunate enough to win a Peabody Award for that.
Yes, no, and it's a great film. Now, let me ask you this. Tell me a little bit about how you and Sam met and how you two work together. You know, sometimes one is the yin, one is the yang, but how do you complement each other and how did you meet?
Sure. So we met, actually, I originally went to film school at Boston University, And when I got out, I wanted to build a business background first, so spent, you know, 12 years working in the real estate investment field, first for someone else and then starting my own company. And then I built the company in, up enough to the point where I felt comfortable enough going out and starting to produce films. So I produced a short film that was at Tribeca called Teacher of the Year, which starred Rachel Dratch. And when it got into the festival, I went down there for about a week, and I was about to go down there to go there, and Sam and I happened to be at the same event, political event, actually, and we struck up a conversation, had never met before, knew some people in common, and I was telling him what I was doing, and he had always been a film aficionado, as well as some, he'd worked on stage crew when he was in high school, and had always been a fan of the behind-the-scenes aspects as well. Real estate entrepreneur, but separate business, different asset class, and we struck up a conversation, and that conversation continues to this day, hours each day. I think we have very different personalities, but they complement each other well, and we basically will do everything together, as opposed to one person doing creative and the other person doing the business side, which has been a great way for us to work.
Now, what is your vision for Burn Later Productions? I mean, you guys have gone very far in three years' time. Where do you see yourself in 3 to 10 years?
Sure. I mean, I would love in 3 years to be putting out, you know, 4 to 5 films a year, similar genres, I think, really honing in on the model that we've started to build. And in 10 years, you know, I'm not sure. I would love to be making content, continuing to do that, to continue to a 3-year plan, certainly, but whether that's working in conjunction with a studio or working with larger financing capacity and working into episodic, you know, content as well for the TV or the web, I think just continuing to tell stories that are compelling and continuing to partner up with great creatives.
Now, let me ask you from a more personal side, you know, and I can completely relate to what you say your journey was of kind of building up, you know, the one aspect of your life. You know, it's sort of like you got to have a gig to pay for your art until your art can be your gig. So what do you feel you learned from being in business, working with, you know, working for and then having your own business that you're able to bring into producing?
I think I learned far more working for myself and on my own than I did at film school, even about film.
Mm.
I think that, you know, there's certain, film school is great, and BU is a great program, but for me, as someone who is really doing business, you know, looking at budgets and marketing and sales and distribution and film finance all day long, those are all skill sets that I learned working in the, you know, for me in the real estate business, but would have learned in general business. And just doing it. I think that's really the way to learn the business, as opposed to, and then that's been a great way for me to learn the business, because on an indie film, you really have to control all those costs because they are your own, as opposed to, you know, working for a larger studio, whereas if you make a mistake, a small mistake, you know, on a studio film could be catastrophic on an independent film.
Sure. Now, let me ask you, what do you, for you, you know, as a producer and as you said, working with new talent and you know, and just kind of putting the whole thing together, what do you find is the most challenging part of being a producer and what's the most rewarding?
The most challenging part, I think, would be just really working before these deals are signed and you're negotiating with the other side who is ultimately going to be your partner. That can be a little awkward at times and off-putting. You put that all behind you once you sign a contract.
Mm-hmm.
But I think getting from that point, getting through, I can take a deep breath out when I know the film is wrapped, essentially.
Right.
I'm more comfortable in post-production and in sales and marketing than I am. You know, there's always so many variables on the set that you just can't control. So that's certainly the most stressful point about what I do. And I think the most rewarding part is really seeing the finished product. And for me, specifically, selling the finished product. I love the audience. You know, there's there's very few things that are as rewarding as someone coming up and saying, hey, I saw Drinking Buddies, or I saw Adult Beginners, or Results, or Best Kept Secret, and really liked it for this reason or that reason. I think that's great. Those are super rewarding. And that's in tandem with having a creative partner like a Joe Swanberg or Nick Kroll or Andy Bujalski, and just having them feel like their mission has been served in the way they wanted to tell their story, and they didn't have to worry about the business side. I find that rewarding.
Well, what's interesting about the films that you guys have produced so far is that they're, to me, they're very, you know, right, would seem maybe not writer director driven, but there's definitely a unique voice. And for someone like myself, who's both a filmmaker and a film critic, I see lots and lots of movies, and very often in the first 5 minutes or even just reading a synopsis, you already know where the movie's going to go. I haven't found that with the three films that I've seen from you guys. How difficult is that for you to find things that don't dip into cliche, and how difficult is it to help keep that unique voice all the way through?
You know, it's, I think when you're matched with a great creative partner and you read the material and it's so different than things you've seen in the past, I feel confident that will go from the page to the screen in an accurate portrayal of that. I've seen a lot of material. You know, you probably look at 50 of these to make one. So I certainly see a lot of material that some is great, but just doesn't fit our model. Some is not that great. But the people we work with, I think, view life and the way they are transcribing life through film in a very different scope than, I think, your average person or filmmaker. And that's what attracts them to us.
I like that phrase, transcribing life through film. That's a good. And now, I guess my last question is, I kind of feel that as you define your art defines you. Since the time that you've taken on being a producer and maybe up to this film now, what have you learned about yourself in terms of just becoming this person you wanted to be after, you know, taking the journey you've taken?
You know, I think I've learned, it's been rewarding to be able to, as an entrepreneur, I think you always feel, you're always happy when you are able to build a successful business, regardless of what that business is. For me, this is especially sweet because this is my lifelong dream. So be able to monetize that, is really, next to have, you know, family and close friends, I think is the most rewarding thing going. I feel I've learned about myself, I think, too, that this isn't, you know, that I wasn't sure this was an attainable goal, the monetization.
Right.
And to find out that it is extremely rewarding for me. And to really hone in on a skill set that I've built in the real estate business and turn that over and make that applicable to a different business that's so different is really rewarding.
Okay.
Hard for me because I'm not someone who pats themselves on the back.
It's okay.
Someone who's at the premiere thinking about the next film.
Right, or patting the director on the back.
Patting someone else.
I can understand that.
Self-praise.
All right, well then, let me just ask this. With the like you said, the skill set you have and jumping headfirst into this business, what advice do you give to up-and-coming producers, and what are some maybe common mistakes that maybe with your stronger business sense, having come into it from that place, that you'd give to others?
I think from where I sit, I think there are many, right, there are many correct paths, if you will, to get to be a successful producer. For me, working in a more traditional business first and honed in building that skill set was the right way for me, and that's the way I would advocate someone that had business interests as well as film interests. Because I just think even if you don't end up to be more of a quote-unquote business producer, and in the indie film that's a fallacy because everybody does everything,
right?
But I would say go out, even if it's just in college and you're taking business classes or getting an internship in a business department of a studio or production company, I think the more you know about every aspect of the film business, the better off you are in doing even your specific job.
I have to say I couldn't agree with that more. Now, let me just ask you, looking at your bio, you know, when do you sleep?
That's ironic because I need a lot of sleep.
Okay.
I go to sleep fairly early, but get up very early. I like to keep busy. I think that that having an active mind and doing a lot of pursuits, whether that's the real estate film or some of the nonprofit endeavors or political things that I'm involved with, all make me putting those all together as part. It's a puzzle, and each makes me better at the rest of it, so to speak.
Okay. All right. And then my last question, Let's say it's 30 years from now, and they're going to do the Paul Brennan retrospective. Hmm. Like, what might they say about the kind of films you would hope to be making?
I would hope that they would say that they were films that were, that ultimately were enjoyed by a lot of different people, and for a lot of different reasons.
Hmm.
That on a surface level, there were stories that were appealing to a broad audience. So a lot of people saw them and I could identify with the characters. But also there were, you know, some layers, a couple layers deep that some people, you know, kind of had different meanings to different people. I'm always fascinated by that.
All right. Well, I got to say, I've really enjoyed your work. Now, what's next? Results, I know, is about to come out.
Yes.
And we've seen another film from you earlier this year, Adult Beginners, which I thought also was terrific. What's in the pipeline? What can we expect?
Yeah, so we sadly don't have anything to announce, but we have three projects in development that hopefully will shoot between late summer to early fall. Several female directed and written films, which is exciting, because we're certainly coming from a different perspective, which I think is great, and two of those which are female writer director and star, and those hopefully will be shot in the fall and come out at some point in 2016.
All right. Well, I hope I get to talk to you again.
Yeah, Mike. Thanks so much for the time.
All right. No, you're welcome.
Take care.
Bye.